And we're holding in Yevamos, page 12, Ois Tes Zayin, beginning of Perek Habal Yevintai. The beginning of the Perek talks about what exactly constitutes Yibum, what kind of Bia, and then further on in the Perek it talks about different other dinim that relate to Bia, including, among other things, what kind of woman a Kohen can marry. We know a regular Kohen is also to marry a Zoyna, so it deals with what the definition of that is in Halacha, and a Kohen Gadol we know has to marry a Bsula, and so it talks about a bunch of dinim related to that whole topic.
Which Chayelet are you on? Which Daf?
Page 12 in Yevamos, Ois Tes Zayin.
Thank you.
Okay, so in the course of the discussion then, the Gemara brings now like this. We know, as a commonplace thing, that a Kohen is not allowed to marry a Geuris. The Gemara brings a pasuk to that effect from Yechezkel. Is it that she's included in the category of Zoyne? Is it that it's a special category? Is it maybe only also Dirabanan? Whatever the case, the point is that it is also for a Kohen to marry a Geuris. Now, though, the Gemara brings the opinion of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, who holds that a Kohen would be allowed to marry a Geuris if she was Nisgayer less than 3 years old. We know in Halacha that up until 3, Bia is not considered Bia. So Reb Shimon would hold then that even if she had undergone Bia at such a young age, it wouldn't be considered Bia la Halacha, and therefore she's not considered a Zoyna. So the Gemara, Reb Shimon brings the following proof. Tanya, so Reb Shimon brings a proof like this. We find by Melchemes Midian, we have the war against Midian that's described in Parshas Matos, where you have they captured a lot of animals and whatnot, and they also captured the pasuk says 32,000 young women. To begin with, actually, the pasuk says they had left alive all the women, and Moshe got angry at them and said these are the very women who were involved in the whole affair with Pur. So after all that's done, they have left 32,000, and the pasukim describe how it was split half among the soldiers who went to war, the 12,000 soldiers, the other half of all the spoils went to the rest of the Jewish people collectively. Each half had to give a portion to one half had to give a portion to Pinchas to Elazar HaKohen, the other part goes to Levium. Whatever the case, the point is that you have Pinchas involved over there, and he's getting some of the spoils because he's one of the ones who went to war. So Reb Shimon says, now the Pasuk phrases it that Moshe says the girls who are too young to have been involved in Bia, hach yulachem, you can keep alive for yourselves, which implies, says Reb Shimon, you could be Megayer them and you could marry them. Well then, if Pinchas is involved over here and Pinchas is a Kohen, that shows that we're talking about girls of such a young age, so therefore, Pinchas as a Kohen would be allowed to marry them. The Chum answer back, that's not a proof. When it says Hach Yulachem, means you'll keep them alive, you'll use them, you'll have them as maidservants, and you can marry them off to your Avodim Knanim eventually. It doesn't mean that Pinchas as a Kohen should be allowed to marry them. Anyway, so in this connection, the Gemara brings Tanya. The Pasuk says, V'chol Isha Yadas Ish. The Pasuk says, any woman who has known a man, meaning on the face of it, it sounds like it means who has actually had Bia. So the Pasuk says those are the ones who are going to be killed. Now, that doesn't mean only the ones who have actually had Bia. The Pasuk is not just talking about where they've actually had Bia, where they're old enough for Bia to be considered Bia in Halacha, which means age 3 or older. Maybe the Pasuk means only if a woman from the captives of Midian has actually had relations, then she's going to be killed, and otherwise not. No, since the next Pasuk continues, all the young children among the women, all the little girls, where they have not known Mishkav Zachar, they have not known. I mean, they haven't had an experience of Mishkav Zachar. The Pasuk says, "Hach Yulachem," you should keep alive for yourselves. So therefore, in other words, and that implies that implies only if she's taf, only if she's a child below a certain age, then we say Hach Yulachem. But if she's older than that, even if Lo Yada Mishkavish, even if she hasn't actually had relations, then not. So therefore, Hevi Omer Bru Uyli Bo Lakosta Medaber. Therefore, the Pasuk is saying the ones who are capable of having relations. So in other words, Yadas Ish doesn't mean that she's actually had relations; just mean that she's of the age that she could. The Gemara actually brings different braises on that. So here in Ein Yaakov, it's not giving all the details, but the point is that that's how the Gemara establishes the difference. So you have, again, the distinction would be the girls and women above a certain age, whether they've actually had relations or not, then they're the ones, harugu, then Moshe says, but any ones who are below that age and have not had relations, hachiu lachem, then you keep alive for yourselves as maidservants. And according to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, you could even a Koyan could be Megayer them and marry them. Okay, well, the question is Minoyadi. How do we know which ones are your das and which ones are not your das? It's not like we have birth certificates to look at how old each one of them is. So Omer Rab Chana or Rab Huna by Bizna, Omer Rab Shimon Chasida, Ha'avirum Lifnei HaTzitz. They had the women and the girls walk in front of the tzitz. So maybe we mean the tzitz was off the Kohen Gadol's forehead. Maybe we mean that Pinchas, as the Kohen Mashuach Melchama, would be wearing it. Maybe even Elazar, as the actual Kohen Gadol, would be wearing it. Whatever the case, they would walk in front of the tzitz. Kol Shepaneh Moirikus. Any of these Goyish women who have face turned Moirikus literally means green. So it means pale, or it means sallow, or whatever. Her face turned a different color. Biyadushi ruili boil. Then you know that she's of the age where she could have relations. And then in that case, then they're goners. Kol she'ena panei marikas, but if her face does not turn that color, biyadushi she'ena ruili boil, then we know that not. Then we know that she's safe. She's below that age. Now the point is, Mephoshim explained, you would ask, if the whole reason Moshe is angry at the soldiers and telling them, how could you keep these women alive? These are the very ones that were involved in Baal Pa'ur. So if there's any of them that weren't involved with men, then what's the problem? Why do we have to kill them? And the answer is because maybe it didn't happen that every single one that we know, the Bechlau, what happened over there? It says the Bnois Moav and the Bnois Midian sent out their women to entice the Jewish people. And unfortunately, many of them did, which is how there was the plague at the end of Parshas Balak over there. The point would be all the ones who were of this age, they sent them out for this purpose and they willingly went along with it. Maybe not necessarily every one of them ended up enticing a Yid and actually having relations, but nevertheless, they were of the age to do it and they were willingly participating in that attempt to subvert the Jewish people, and therefore they have to go. Mashenkin, if they're below that age, where bia is not meaningful in halacha anyway, and they're too little really to understand the difference, then we can say that they weren't involved in that, and therefore they can be left alive. Why dafka that sits? Marsha points out, you know, we have the bracha Yor Hashem Ponav Eilecha, that Hashem will make his face shine towards you. And besides that means that, so to speak, Hashem's face will shine towards us and it'll show us a friendly face, so to speak. It also means when we have Hashem's name involved, our faces glow with the closeness of Hashem. So now you have the other way around, because Kodesh L'Hashem, it says on the tzitz, holy for Hashem. The Jewish people are holy to Hashem. On the other hand, we're saying these Bnois Midian are the very opposite of that. Therefore, their face turns a different color when they're in front of the tzitz.
There's a time in the Chumash where the sun showed who was guilty and who was not.
That was also in the connection with Bnois Midian over there, where Rashi mentions at the end of Parshas Balak that the Onan, the Ananiah covered, would fold up and expose to the sunlight any of the men who were involved with the Avodah Zarah and everything of Bnois Midian. But here we're talking about in the aftermath of that. That's at the end of Parshas Balak. After that, the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, after Pinchas has stopped the plague and after has killed Zimri and Cosby and stopped the plague and all that, Hashem tells Moshe Tzorer as a Midyanim. You have to consider the Moyavim, the Midyanim, permanent enemies, Vikisim Oisam, and fight against them. And eventually in Parshas Matos, they actually go to war. And this is what we're talking about, the aftermath of that war. An interesting point. So, and the Gemara mentions in this connection, Omer Rav Nachman, Simen La'Avera Hidroikam. A simon that you can see on a person who was involved with Avera, and Avera, unspecified in Gemara terminology, often means Znus. Hidroikon is a disease called Hidroikon, which, among other things, makes a person's face turn that color, turn sallow. Tosfos points out that, strictly speaking, it's not the same thing. There is a disease called Yerokan, which is jaundice, where the person really turns yellow. Hidroikon is not that exactly. Hidroikon is actually usually translated as a disease that's called in English. Okay. Shh. Yeah. usually in English, hidroikon is translated in English as a disease called edema, called in medical ease edema, where a person retains water where they shouldn't. Normally, a person is supposed to have, of course, a certain, your body is like 80% water or whatever the percentage is, but sometimes you have where there's a buildup of fluid, there's a buildup of water in the tissues where there doesn't belong, and it's called in medical ease edema. Usually, that's hidroikon is identified as that. Tosfos points out, based on this Gemara over here, apparently it also makes a person's face turn a little bit greenish or sallow or whatever, which is why the Gemara focused on that symptom. So now when they saw that these girls, their and women, their face would turn that color, then we know that they were either actually involved in Aveira and Znus, or at least that they're potentially able to, and they were again among the women who went out for this purpose to try and seduce the Jewish people, and therefore that's it, they're goners. There was an interesting vote on it also from there was an interesting vort on it actually from the Gerer Rebbe, the Pnei Menachem. He says, the Gemara mentions elsewhere. We mentioned it briefly in the Yerushalmi that we learned a few weeks back. It's mentioned in the Bavli and Zvachim. Each of the big de Kahuna was mechaper for a different avera. The tzitz was mechaper for azus metzach, when a person is brazen and chutzpahdik. Now, so therefore, so in other words, the tzitz has a certain affinity for finding out the people who have that quality. Well, the Bnois Midian have that quality of Azus that they went out brazenly, unlike women are usually more tzniistic, and they went out brazenly to seduce the Jewish people. Therefore, they're the ones, therefore the tzitz is what caught them. Okay. Now the Gemara says, Kayotze b'davar ata omer. Here's a similar thing where at one point in Jewish history, they needed to do a mass test to see who is a besula and who's not. Now, it's not exactly the same thing because here by the Bnois Midian, we're not checking whether they're besulas. We're just checking whether they're the age for bia to be meaningful. In the next case, we're going to talk about it's to actually check whether they're physically besulas, but still, they had a large number of people and they needed to have a tzniistic way of doing it. So it's like this. We have the story of Pilegesh Begiva. At the end of Sefer Shoftim, we have the whole tragedy of Pilegesh Begiva. To make a long story short, there's a yid from Har Ephraim, from the center of Eretz Yisrael. He's gone to Beis Lechem to fetch his Pilegesh. They're on their way back home. They stop in Giva, a town a little bit north of Yerushalayim. Nowadays, it's in the area, one of the northern suburbs of Yerushalayim, Pisgat Zev, or that area. At Kitzer, they come to the city square. Nobody wants to be Machnes Orach. One yid comes and is Machnes Orach, and then everybody in the town comes and surrounds the house and demand that the guests be handed over to them, somewhat like in our parsha where we have Loit and the people of Sodom, although actually usually the Ramban actually discusses it and says there are some important differences. But one thing he says, the law, the official law in Sodom was that there was not to be any guests, and if there are any, then we're going to mistreat them. In Giva, there was no such law. It was just there were a bunch of people over there who had a powerful Yetzirah. And he points out there are a number of other differences between the two stories. Anyway, we see, after all, that after this whole thing of Pilegesh Begiva, anyway, the upshot of it was that the guy's Pilegesh was raped and killed. And when everybody found out about it, all the rest of the Shvatim are outraged, and they decide they go to Shevet Binyamin. You have to hand over these miscreants from Giva, and we'll punish them. The Shevet Binyamin basically says, "Mix out of our business. We'll deal with it internally." So the rest of the Shvatim went to war against them. There was a civil war. That's what Ramban points out. That's another distinction. You see, by Sodom, none of the other Canaanim cared about what's going on in Sodom, and they just had to punish them. Mashen can hear. We have the rest of the Jewish people are all outraged that such a thing should happen, and they took immediate steps about it. Kitzer Amaisa, anyway, the Pesukim described most of it. There were several battles. The upshot of it was most of Shevet Binyamin was wiped out. Now, there were 600 men left altogether. Now, the Pesukim then described like this.
Where is the Ramban saying it?
The Ramban mentions this in our parasha, actually, when he deals with the story of Loit and the guests in Sodom. He mentions this point about the story in Sefer Shoftim, and he mentions the distinctions between them. Good question. The upshot was that most of Shevet Binyamin was wiped out. Now, the Pesukim go on to describe, during the heat of all of this, while all of this was going on, they had gathered everybody together and they made a cherem. In the name, at that point, there was no king, by Yom HaMahemin Melech B'Yisrael. The Sanhedrin was running things, and the national Sanhedrin made a cherem. Nobody should intermarry with Shevet Binyamin. Nobody's allowed to have their daughters marry a man from Shevet Binyamin or to marry a woman from Shevet Binyamin. But, now, after, one second, one second. Now, after it was all over, and all that was left is 600 men from Binyamin, they started thinking to themselves, you know what? How can we allow a Shevet to go extinct? So
they were holy.
Yeah. So what are we going to do about it? So they put their heads together and figure they gather all together in Mitzpah, which was a place where the Jewish people would regularly gather for such things. And they looked to see, first of all, like this, we made a cherem that's binding on the whole Jewish people. And to begin with, we gathered together the whole Jewish people to punish Binyamin for their role in all of this. Now, was there anybody who did not join us at the time? If so, then it means, first of all, they're separating themselves from the rest of the Jewish people, and that's a pretty serious thing in itself. They're over on a cherem that everybody was supposed to gather over there, and if we find any such people, they have to be punished. They checked into it, they found there's a town in Eivra Yaudin called Yovish Gilad, where in fact none of them had shown up at this mass assembly. So now, they realized, on the one hand, the people of that city need to be punished, because how could they separate themselves from the rest of the Jewish people? Everybody is gathering there in outrage over what happened in Giv'ah, and they're just sitting on the sidelines like it doesn't matter to us. In fact, Das Sofrim points out, you know, as it is, you have the Shvatim and Eivra Yaudin, there's always the concern they seem to be more the type that are going to peel off more easily since they're separated by the Yaudin from everybody else, so we have to take extra steps with them to make sure that they don't, that they stay part of the body of the Jewish people. So that's first of all. But second, there was also the point, if they're not concerned about the znus that happened over there in Giv'ah, then it may mean that they themselves are into that kind of thing. But more to the point also that everybody realized, we have now, in this way, we have an out over here. We all joined in a cherem that nobody's allowed to intermarry with the Shevet Binyamin. But Yavish Gilad, since the people of that town didn't join in that cherem, then they women from there would be able to marry Shevet Binyamin. So let's go. So they decided like this. They sent soldiers. They sent a unit of soldiers to fight against Yavish Gilad and Can and conquer the city and kill everybody over there, except for they should leave alive any women that they found that are Besulis, and they're going to bring them back. They're going to give them as wives to Shevet Binyamin. The upshot of it is the Pesukim described that as the Gemara is going to bring over here the Pesuk, they found 400. 400 girls is not enough for 600 men, and they had to take other steps to get the other 200 men wives as well. That's not part of the relevant story over here. The point is, the Pesuk says, Vayimtsu, so after they had gone and destroyed and killed the people of Yavish Gilad as a punishment for not participating with the rest of the Jewish people in this, and this is another Ramban, by the way, that Ramban at the end of Parshas Bechukosai brings based on a Pesuk over there, that when the king or the national Sanhedrin decides on something like that's binding on the whole Jewish people, if somebody goes and violates that, then they can be Chayav Misa. And here's an example where they wiped out the city of most of the city of Yavish Gilad for failing to join in with the rest of the Jewish people in this whole thing. Anyway, so the Pesuk says, "Vayimtsu miyoshve Yavish Gilad arba meis narab sula." They found among the residents of Yavish Gilad, they found 400 girls who were besulis, asher lo yoda ish l'mishkav zocher, that had not known any man and had not had any relations with men. And again, they kept them alive and they brought them back to Eretz Yisrael proper, and they offered them to 400 of the men of Shevet Binyamin as wives. So the question is mino yadi. How would they know who is a besula or not? The Gemara is assuming they didn't just go and do a physical examination. So they didn't actually have women go and do a gynecological examination, Lamazogin. So how did they actually do it? They had each of the girls from Yavish Gilad sit on top of an open barrel of wine. If she's previously had relations and therefore her besulim are gone, then you would be able to smell the smell of the wine, the aroma of the wine from her mouth. Besula in Recha Noidef, and she's a besula, if she still has her the membrane over there, the besulim, then it would not. How does that work physiologically? I once saw somebody point out, after all, you do have medically, you can have, you know, something can, you can have alcohol can diffuse through the tissues and end up on the breath. You know, sometimes you have a person can fail a breathalyzer test, not just from drinking alcohol, for example, but by having skin contact with it, for example. So here you would have the same kind of thing, that they could absorb it. They could absorb a certain amount of it through that area. Anyway, so the question is, so the 400 who passed that test are the ones who became the wives and the mothers of the next generation of Shevet Binyamin. Well, the question is, v'navirenu lefnei atzitz, why did they use the wine barrel method? Why didn't they use the tzitz method? The same way as they used the tzitz method for the girls of Midian, they should have used it over here for Yavish Gilad. Now, to be sure, it's the opposite kind of thing. There they wanted the women, it's not really the opposite. There they wanted the girls who are too young to have had relations here. We don't care about their age, just that they're still basolas. But still, the point is, in other words, that the tzitz should have whatever effect is necessary to tell between one and the other. So the answer is Amar of Kahana, Breidir of Nachman, L'rotzen lahem k'siv. The pasuk says that the tzitz is meant to be for favor for the Jewish people, meaning L'rotzen v'lo the Peronis. The tzitz is only meant to bring favor of Hashem to the Jewish people, not punishment. The fact is, these people of Yavish Gilad, as much as they had done wrong by not joining in the great assembly and the great cherem and all of that, the fact is they're still Jews, and we don't want that the tzitz should be used for punishment to them. In other words, that would go, again, with us Jewish people, Yor Hashem Ponev Elacha, so it wouldn't be appropriate that the face of Hashem, so to speak, the name of Hashem that's on the tzitz, Kodesh LaHashem, should be used to punish and kill Jews. So the Gemara asks, Yehochi b'minyan nami. At this point, the Gemara doesn't realize that there's a difference between Jews and Goyim in that regard. The Gemara thinks when we say l'rotzon means for favor, v'loy l'peronis means across the board. The tzitz should never be used for punishment. So the question is, Yehochi b'minyan nami. Well, then back to Midian. Then why by Midian are we using the tzitz to separate out the ones who are to be killed? The answer is Amar Ravashi lahem k'sid. Because the pasuk says l'rotzon lahem. For favor for them, the Jewish people. L'rotzen v'lo, meaning lahem l'rotzen v'lo l'peronis. For them, the Jewish people, the tzitz is meant to be used only for rotzen, only to bring Hashem's favor, not for punishment. L'ovid k'chavim afilu l'peronis, but for goyim it can be used for punishment as well. So therefore, some Midian, we're talking about goyish women over there, then the tzitz could be used to mark some of them that they're going to be for misa, as opposed to here by Yavish Gilad, they could only use the tzitz for the good purpose they couldn't use it for this purpose because it would be saying that some of them are going to be killed, and therefore they had no choice but to use the wine barrel method. There is the question anyway that if they could use the wine barrel method, what's the question anyway? Why should they be using the tzitz, which is derech nes? One answer could be, the wine barrel test is not going to be 100%, it's not going to necessarily be 100% accurate, whereas the tzitz would, but nevertheless, because the tzitz is not meant for punishment for the Jewish people, therefore they couldn't use it. Okay. Onward. Then the Gemara.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It was what was the story with the people of Beitar? They died out, and then they stopped to die, and they buried them all, and then at that point, Shrava Ben Yomin was available to get populated again.
I don't know what you're talking about. Beitar was after the second Mishmash was destroyed. No, what you have is over here, this very story that we're talking about. Again, after the affair in Giva over there, after the whole thing with Pelegish Begiva, there was a civil war. Most of Shrava Ben Yomin was killed. All that was left was 600 men. And then now at that point, the rest of the Shevatim realized we can't allow the Shevet to go extinct. We have to take steps to repopulate the Shevet. And this business with Yavish Gilad was part of that.
So in Ein Yaakov's.
I don't know what you're referring to. After that, there were 200 men from Shevet Binyamin who didn't have wives. So then they had the whole thing where on Chamisha Asa B'Av, the girls are going and dancing in the vineyards. And then they told Shevet Binyamin, hide out over there and each of you grab a girl for himself. That's one of the things we celebrate on Chamisha Asa B'Av. That's one of the things we celebrate on Tuma of, in fact, is that Hutra Shvatim Love Zebazer, that Shutra Shevet Binyamin Love Bakoho, that Shevet Binyamin was allowed to reintegrate into the Jewish people. Okay, onward. Yeah, okay, onward. Further on in the Sugya, having mentioned this opinion of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, which the halacha is not like him, by the way, but the opinion that he says that a kohen is allowed to marry a giyurdis who was converted less than 3 years old. So the Gemara mentions another din that he says regarding goyim. There's also a connection in that when the Gemara discusses the opinion of his that we're going to mention over here, it mentions something in connection with the war with Midian. So that's another connection. Anyway, what it is Rav Shimon bar Yochai Omer, kivrei kusim einem matamim ba'oil. Graves of goyim, of course, it was changed by the censors. It's really supposed to be goyim or nochrim or what have you. Einem matamin ba'oil. They are not matame if a person overshadows them. We know that normally a mess is matame in one of three ways: maga if you touch it, masa if you carry it even without touching it, for example, carrying it in a box, and oihel if you're under the same roof as the mess or if you overshadow it or it overshadows you. Rav Shimon holds that maga and masa apply to goyish corpses, but oihel does not. Shenema, he says, because the Pasuk says, because the Pasuk says about Tumas Oil, it says Odom ki Yomus Boil. When an Odom dies in a tent, then you have Tumas Oil. And Shenema, the Pasuk says in Yechezkel, Ba'atein Soni, you my sheep. There's a whole perek in Yechezkel over there where Hashem gives a long metaphor over there of the Jewish people as like a flock of sheep that have been abandoned and abused and whatever by their shepherds, representing the Jewish kings, who many of them didn't treat the Jewish people the way they should, and the flock is scattered and so on and so forth. And Hashem says, "I'm going to bring you all back together and bring you to Eretz Yisrael." And then at the end of the chapter, Yechezkel says, "Va'atein soini, you my sheep, soin marisi, the sheep of my shepherding, odam atem, you are odam." Meaning, we learn from that, Atem kruyim Odom, vein kusim kruyim Odom. You Jewish people are called Odom, the goyim are not called Odom. So therefore, says Reb Shimon, when it says Odom ki yomus ba'oihel, then that means to exclude goyim. The big machloikas, whether in fact the halacha is like Reb Shimon in that. There's big machloikas aposkim on that question, which is very relevant nowadays. For example, when koyanim travel, you travel on streets where there are which pass by goyish cemeteries, and you have trees, for example, that partially overhang the cemetery. God, am I giving the shiur or are you?
Please.
No. I will explain, okay? If you have a question that you don't understand something, please do. But if you just want to make comments, then please hold them to yourself. Thank you. Okay. Now, for example, you have streets, even here in Brooklyn, for example, you go along Bay Parkway, let's say you're passing in the middle, passing down between two halves of a big goyish cemetery over there, and you have trees, for example, that partially overhang the cemetery and partially overhang the street. Is a kohen allowed to walk or drive on that street? It's a big argument among the poskim. Is a kohen allowed to fly in a plane that goes over a goyish cemetery? There's a big question to what is the halacha like Reb Shimon or not. As far as this Atem Kruyim Odom, now there's a lot of explanations what that means exactly. I mean, certainly the Gemara is not saying that Goyim are less than human. First of all, Tosfos has a long discussion over here. There are quite a number of places in Tanakh where, first of all, the Gemara itself asks, actually, there are a few places where we use the word Odom to mean Goyim as well. So the Gemara points out, for example, when you're talking about versus animals, then yes, the word Odom can be used of people, because you have to make a distinction, people versus animals, so then Odom can be used to mean Goyim. Tosfos points out more examples as well. Tosfos also points out, Rabbeinu Tam says, there may be a difference between the word Odom and Ha-Odom. Ha-Odom would mean, Ha-Odom means any human being, Goyim or Jews. Odom specifically refers to the Jewish people, with the exceptions that the Gemara mentions and other similar exceptions like that, where we have no choice but to use the word Odom to distinguish from Hashem or to distinguish from animals or what have you. Why should it be that Odom represents specifically the Jewish people? So again, there were a few explanations about it. One is that Odom harks back to Adam edition, Yitzir Kapov, Shalach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem created him, so to speak, with his own hands, with a purpose, and we Jewish people, eventually you have, originally, the Kuzari makes this point, for example, you have in the early generations of humanity, Hashem had individual people who are upholding what the Eibishter wants for the world. You have Adam, you have Mr. Shalach, you have Noach, and so forth. They're the one Tzadik Yisod Olam, basically. Eventually, the Eibishter gets to the point, he doesn't just want one individual, Avraham, or Yitzchak, or Yaakov, or whatever. He wants an entire people that should live up to what Adam was supposed to be, and we Jewish people are that, and therefore we have the title Adam, and the rest of the nations who are not living up to that, they don't deserve that title. That's one point. Another point, actually, an interesting point that the Olal HaSifrayim, Sefer of Droshes by the Kli Yoker, points out. We have four words in Lashon Kodesh for a person: Adam, Ish, Gever, and Enosh. All of them can be pluralized except for Adam. There's no plural for the word Adam. Therefore, it represents specifically the Jewish people, where we are one unitary nation. We have a lot of individuals among us, but we're koyma achas shlema. We're one unified people, unlike the rest of the nations. Al derech, like you have the famous medrash that says that Yaakov, when he and his family are going down to Mitzrayim, and there are 70 of them, and it says nefesh in the singular, whereas Esav has six people in his family when they're leaving Eretz Yisrael and going to Har Seir, and it says nefesh nafshois plural, because each of them has his own getchkes and whatnot. There was a very famous example in history where this point was brought up. Everybody knows over here about the famous trial of Mendel Bayliss 110 or so years ago. There was a Yid by the name of Mendel Bayliss in Russia, was accused of, there was a blood libel, a Goyish kid was found dead, and they accused him. Kitzam Isa, they made a whole trial of it, of course, and Gdoli Yisrael from all over got involved, because they realized it's not just an accusation. First of all, just that it's an accusation against one Yid is enough reason to get involved, but especially they realized this is against the whole Jewish people collectively. The Rebbe Rashab, we know, was very heavily involved. He opened up his library freely to the lawyer who was working on it, for example, to do whatever research he did. Anyway, one of the points that came up at one point, the prosecution brought up this Gemara over here, Atam Kriyam Adam, knew, he says, you see, that you Jews consider Goyim to be less than human. So famously at that time, Reb Meir Shapiro was a young Rav at the time. He gave an answer based on this Odalus Ephraim. He says, so you say, we're saying that the word Adam can't be pluralized, meaning that, again, that we Jewish people are as if one person. He says, look at, you see this with this very trial. You have one individual Yid is on trial. Now imagine, for example, he says, you have one individual Frenchman on trial. Does every French person in the world get involved to defend him? No. Same thing with any other nationality. But here you have one individual Yid is on trial and all the Jewish people are rushing to help him out. That's the Atam Kriyam Adam that you have only by us, that you don't have by any other nation.
One pasuk from Tehillim. How David HaMelech called Adam b'fi'atmo.
Fine. Okay, so he's talking about the Jewish people collectively. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay, good.
All right,
okay. Onward. The next Mishnah talks about in this parak talks about the rules of whom a Kohen Gadol can marry. Now we have like this. We know a Kohen Gadol has to marry a Bsula. He's not allowed to marry an Almana. What happens? The Mishnah describes if a Kohen has been Makadish, has done Kiddushin with an Almana, and then he's appointed Kohen Gadol. Is he allowed to marry her or not? The Mishnah says yes, he is. And the Mishnah gives an example, Maisa Yeshua ben Gamla. It happened with Yeshua ben Gamla in the time of the second Beis Mikdash, Shekiddush L'Marta Bas Baisus. He did Kiddushin with Marta Bas Baisus, who was a widow, Umino HaMelech Lias Kohen Gadol. Then the king appointed Yeshua ben Gamla as Kohen Gadol, V'konsa V'chola, and then Yeshua ben Gamla ended up marrying her, and the Chachamim didn't object, which shows, that bears out, Halacha L'Maisa, what the Mishnah is saying about if he was Mekadosher. So had he not been Mekadosher, he wouldn't be allowed to now that he's a Kohen Gadol, but once he was Mekadosher, as a regular Kohen, then he's allowed to go through with it. Now, so the Gemara points out, Minohu Eid, the expression in the Mishnah is Minohu, that the king appointed him.
Who did he marry?
He married Marta Bas Baisus, was her name. Now, we do find a Marta Bas Baisus who lived at the time of the Churban. Famously, we have in the story of the Churban in Perakan, in Gittin, in Perakan Izokin, we have the rich Marta Bas Baisus over there, who she sent her servant to the marketplace to get flour. And each time he comes back and says, the kind of the quality of flour that you want isn't available anymore. And the Kitzer Amaisa, she ended up dying of hunger over there. But so was that the same Marta Bas Baisus over here? Maybe, maybe not. We'll talk about in a minute who this, when during the second Beis Mikdash, we'll talk about when this Yeshua ben Gamla lived. So hold that thought a minute.
Over here, she was a Gioris?
No. If she was a Gioris, then only if she was a Gioris, then she wouldn't have been allowed to marry him. No, she was a born Jewish woman, but she was an Almana. She had previously been married, and her husband had died. So only a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry an Almana. A Kohen Hedyot is. Therefore, since he had been Mekadosh as a Kohen Hedyot, therefore he's fine. Yeah, she's born Jew. Yeah.
Okay. He did marry her.
Yeah. Okay, so the Gemara points out.
That was okay.
That's what we're saying. It was okay, yeah. That's what we're saying. As long as he was Mekadosher as a Kohen Hedyot, then it's fine for him to go ahead with the Nisuin, even though he's Kohen Gadol already. Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara says, Minohu ein nisman aloi. Now you notice the wording in the Mishnah. It says the king appointed him. It does not say he was appointed. Minohu would imply the king appointed him, but the other Kohenim didn't really approve, and the Sanhedrin didn't approve of it. Nismana would be that he was appointed the right way by his fellow Kohenim, found him to be the best candidate, and the Sanhedrin ratified that. Instead, we're saying Minohu, that the king did it kind of unilaterally. So what's going on? I see over here there was a conspiracy over here. Ktir literally means a bond, a knot. So you have the expression in Lashon Kodesh, Rashi brings Kesher Shol Rishoyim, a knot, meaning a conspiracy of Rishoyim. In other words, this Yeshua ben Gamla was not really Roy. He wasn't really the best candidate for the position. To Omer of Asi, as in fact, Rav Asi says, how did Yehoshua ben Gamla get appointed? Tarkava the dinri, Ila le Mautabas Baisus, Lyane Malka, Yan Maut, this Mautas Bas Baisus, again, the woman who he had been Makadish and was on the verge of marrying, she was rich. She brought a tarkav of gold coins. A tarkav is a container that holds three saw. That holds three kavim, rather. Tarkav stands for trei v'kav, two kavim plus one more kav, so three kavim of gold coins. A kav being somewhere around 3 pounds. You're talking about quite a lot of gold coins. L'yanei Malka, she brought that as a bribe to Yanei Melech. Ad demuki l'Yeshua ben Gamla b'kana ravrava, so that he should appoint her chosin Yeshua ben Gamla as the next kohen gadol, and that's improper because he didn't really deserve the position. Now, there is a bit of discussion about that because you have other Gemaras, you have a different Gemara in Baba Basra that mentions Yeshua ben Gamla in a very praiseworthy way. It says if it weren't for him, the Torah would have been forgotten from among the Jewish people because he's the one who came up with the idea that there should be chadorim and there should be melamdim in every city. The Gemara describes originally a boy would be taught by his father, v'shinantam levanecha. Later on, they had yeshivas for older children, and later on they had yeshivas specifically in Yerushalayim and specifically for older children. Yeshua ben Gamla is the first one who came up with the concept that boys already 6-7 years old should be going to cheder in every town. And if it weren't for him, the Torah would have been forgotten, the Gemara says, so therefore he's praiseworthy. What are we saying over here then that he wasn't deserving of the position of Kohen Gadol? So there's a few possibilities. One is, sure, he was a good guy, but there was better possible candidates than him for Kohen Gadol. So his wife, or his Kala rather, whatever, bribed the king to appoint him, but still, that shouldn't have been done. It would have been better if somebody else more deserving of the position had been appointed. Another possibility is Faket. He was the most deserving, but without Shoychad, Yanai HaMelech wouldn't agree to it. So the Shoychad was not to get in an improper candidate, but rather to have the king allow it, where otherwise they shouldn't have needed that in the first place. Lahalocha, in fact, poskim talk about the question to what extent. You know, it used to be very common in Europe sometimes that Rabbanim would buy their position through the government, and a lot of Achronim talk about the question how kosher v'yosher is that. And one of the Gemaras that come one of the precedents that comes into it is this Gemara over here. Anyway, there is another explanation that there were actually two Yeshua ben Gamlas. When it comes to the one about Chadorim, The Bavli credits it to Yeshua ben Gamla, but the Yerushalmi credits it to Shimon ben Shattach. And we know when Shimon ben Shattach lived, he lived in the middle of the time of the second Beis Mikdash. On the other hand, again, the famous Maut Bas Baisus lived at the time of the Churban, which would place Yeshua ben Gamla then as well. So there is the possibility that there were actually two Yeshua ben Gamlas. There was the good one who was in the middle of the second Beis Mikdash, and he's the one who, together with Shimon ben Shattach, worked on setting up Chadorim. And then there would be this no good Nick over here whose wife brought him into the position. So those are the two possibilities, basically. Those are the various possibilities. Yeah. Okay. Yom Mashiach Gula.
No comparison to me.
Yom Mashiach Gula, Yud Aleph Cheshvan. The purpose for which Hashem created the world is lasis leis baruch dir v'tachtonim. And our world is tachtonim, ein tachton, l'mata himenu. There's nothing lower in the world. There's nothing lower in the world's v'ruchnias than our world. And Hashem expects us to make it a dir v'tachtonim. Now that was partially accomplished in the Mishkan and the Beis Mikdash, because there you could see with your own eyes the fact that the Shekhinah is resting over there, but it wasn't completely fulfilled. Really, what makes it completely be accomplished is the Avodah that we do Dafka now in the time of Golos, when the Gashmias of the world is in its full power, and still we use it, and still we go and we use it for our Avodah, and we transform this Gashmias into a Dira Lo Yisbarach. That really transforms even the lowest strata, the lowest layers of our world, even more than was able to be accomplished in the Mishkan and in the Beis Mikdash. Continuing with halachas of pets and other animals on Shabbos. So, So you are allowed. We talked about leading an animal around on a leash. And the basic rule, as we learned yesterday, is if a leash is necessary in order to keep the animal from running away, then that's a valid thing for it to wear on Shabbos. But if, for example, if it's the kind of animal that doesn't need that, then you wouldn't necessarily be allowed to. Now, one thing is, though, there are rules about it. You have to make sure that the leash doesn't hang below your hand, a tefach, because then it makes it look as though you're just carrying the leash. It also can't sag so that it's within a tefach of the ground, for the same reason, because then it looks like just you're schlepping a rope over there. So if the leash is too long, then you'd have to shorten it or wrap it loosely around the animal's neck or whatever, and you have to follow those rules.
You have to keep it tight.
You have to keep it so it has to be relatively tight so that it's not within a tefach of the ground, and so that a tefach of the leash doesn't stick out from your hand, because either of those things would make it look like you're carrying the leash on Shabbos. In that connection, Achronim talk about, for example, often you have tags on an animal to see so people will know whose it is, or to show that it has its shots or whatever, different kinds of things that are required in different places. Would it be, well, you allowed to have the animal, you're allowed to have the pet go out with such things on an animal?
Okay,
God, I know what I'm saying, and I know what I'm saying is correct. I don't really need you to comment on it every second, okay? Okay, now.
Like the tags around the neck of the
dog? Yeah, sometimes you have. For example, you have owner's tags, you have tags that in some places are required to show that it had such and such shots or whatever. So are you allowed to on Shabbos? There's a good deal of discussion among the poskim, where one distinction is it necessary for the animal itself? For example, let's say a name tag to show whose it is, that's for the purpose of the animal, because if it gets lost, then whoever finds it is not necessarily going to take good care of it. Mashenkin, for example, if it's the kind of thing where if you have your dog go out on, if you have your, you may have a law, local law, that says if your pet, whatever, doesn't go out with such and such a tag, you might get a fine. That's not a valid reason to have it go out with that on Shabbos, because not for the purpose of the animals, for the purpose of you. And that's not necessarily a valid reason to allow it to be worn on Shabbos. So for each individual case, individual cases like that, you would have to ask a rov if such a thing comes out.